My name is Mark Fest, and my dog's name is Zeus. We're at South Point Park, which is the southernmost point in Miami Beach. I come here every morning and every afternoon with my dog Zeus. You got people on rollerblades, people on segways. The other day I was here and a diver suddenly came climbing out of the water. It's one of the most beautiful settings you could possibly imagine.
You're listening to WLRN.
WLRN.
91.3.
And it is WLRN 91.3. Joseph Cooper here with Bonnie Berman. It's today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Today we visit with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. He's written Gods Like Us on movie stardom and modern fame. And he joins us from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Ty Burr.
Thanks for having me on.
And welcome to you. Why don't we begin today where you begin your book with your revealing interaction with Robin Williams and your takeaway from that experience.
This happened a number of years ago when I was living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I came out one morning to go for a jog around the Central Park Lake. And I was stretching my legs, warming up, and somebody comes out of the apartment building next door and starts stretching his legs. And I look over and I give him a friendly little nod, and he gives me a little friendly nod back. And as I say in the book, a bunch of things happened, invisible things happened in rapid succession. First, I realized he was Robin Williams. Second, I realized he was Robin Williams. And third, he just shut down. His face completely, it was like a wall just came down and his eyes went dead. And that little moment of just human connection, it was gone because he went into protective mode, and I certainly didn't. You know, being a New Yorker and also living at that point three blocks from where John Lennon was killed, you're very, very aware of giving famous people their space in such a tightly packed, urban environment.
And so what did that make you feel?
It made me realize what it must be like for somebody who is famous on that level to just go through the world on a day-to-day basis. And I've encountered this again with actors and celebrities I've interviewed for my job at the Boston Globe, just the amount of interaction they have just going through the day where people come up to them expecting them to be that person they see on the screen, not the actual smaller human being they are right then and there.
Well, my co-host Bonnie could tell you what it's like to have that celebrity rush.
Yes. Thank you, Joe.
And what's interesting, I actually had a conversation recently with George Segal, the actor. I was interviewing him for a piece I'm doing, and he happened to have read that part of the book, and he said, "You absolutely nailed it. That's exactly what it's like to be on the other side of that interaction. You just shut down. The wall comes down. It's the only way you can deal sometimes."
Do we want our stars to reflect us in some way or be completely on another plane?
We want both. That's the sort of terrible push-pull of it. We want to ennoble them. We look up to them. They do seem larger than life when we see them on these big screens. And yet, you know, we want them. We don't trust that. We want them to be like us. We want to be like them. When they do behave like us, flaws and all, sometimes we take too much pleasure in the fact that there's a real person there. It's a very complicated dynamic, which I spent a lot of time in the book trying to parse and pull apart.
Well, you take on the evolution of movie celebrity and stardom, and you start at the end of the 19th century with the invention of movies to today. So first, why don't we begin early on and tell us how movie actors were regarded in the earliest of times?
Well, they weren't taken very seriously at all. I mean, in the very earliest days of movies, their motion pictures were a novelty. What actors did on screen wasn't even considered acting. People described them. The words they used to describe what actors did on screen was not, they didn't use the word acting. They used posing, shamming, rolling around and jumping up and down. It was almost as if the vocabulary came from photography rather than the stage. That's where, you know, back then, that's where real actors were. They were on the stage. But something changed as audiences started going to more and more movies, and the movies started becoming more popular. They started reacting to these people because they were, first of all, the camera gives every audience member the best seat in the house. It brings you right up close to the actor in a way that is just not possible with the stage. And so the nature of the acting has to change. It becomes less showy, less demonstrative, more intimate. And it also mattered that these early films were often about husbands and wives and, you know, not famous people, not Shakespearean heroines, but domestic, real people. So people really had a different relationship with these stars, and they became obsessed with them in a way that the culture at the time couldn't understand at all.
So who was truly the first big-time movie star?
Well,
back
the first
in the silent
one,
era.
The first one billed by name was an actress pretty much lost to history named Florence Lawrence. For the first 15 years, the movies did not bill actors by name. All you got when you went to a movie was the title and the company that made it. And then one particular producer, the man who founded Universal Pictures, a man named Carl Laemmle, figured it out by watching audiences and reading, you know, the fan mail, and he started billing Florence Lawrence by name and you know, sending her out on a tour where she was mobbed. It was the first movie star mob. But the first movie star to really be a global phenomenon, there's really two, and they come around at around the same time, 1914, 1915. One of them is Mary Pickford, you know, the plucky little girl who was playing plucky little girls into her mid-30s. And the other was Charlie Chaplin, of course, the first slapstick comedian who proved that what he did was also art.
And when and why was it decided that the stars needed to be molded and manufactured, you know, with their names changed and their looks changed and their marital status changed? And give us some of the more well-known examples of that.
Well, basically what happens is you get into the mid-silent period, you know, the industry starts organizing itself into a factory system. And especially once it gets over the trauma of the transition to sound, which really was an industrial calamity, where the audience just said, you know what, we don't like silent movies anymore. We only want to see stuff where people talk. And then they had to figure out what talking actors sounded like. Did they sound like Broadway? Did they sound like, you know, highfalutin Shakespearean language? No, they had to find actors who sounded like themselves, people like Mae West and Jimmy Stewart and Katharine Hepburn and James Cagney. Nobody else sounds like those people. But by the time that happened, the major studios had really turned into a factory system where, you know, they're doing something very paradoxical. They're mass producing unique identities, unique performers.
Time.
And they got very, very good at it, and they owned these people. They signed them to 7-year contracts, and those 7-year contracts had a way of getting extended and extended and extended. And they changed their names, and they changed their noses, and they gave them elocution lessons. And yes, they did apparently pay off Johnny Weissmuller's wife to get a divorce. I think they might have been having problems already, because he was so popular with women at the time. It's amazing the amount of control that the studios had over their employees. They were the factory parts. There's a story that at MGM, the studio executives had a charting the menstrual cycles of all their major actresses, so they would just know, you know, who was, quote, feeling fresh and who might be using that as an excuse. Mm. That's how much control they actually had over their stars.
Ty Burr, how about if we hear a little bit of Mae West?
Well, when I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I see a man in your life.
What, only one?
Well, when I'm caught between two evils, I generally like to take the one I never tried.
Aren't you forgetting that you're married?
I'm doing my best.
Well, it's better to be looked over than overlooked.
I wonder what kind of a woman you really are.
Too bad, but I can't give out samples. You know, I always did like a man in a uniform. That one fits you grand. Why don't you come up sometime, see me? I'm home every evening.
Yeah, but I'm busy every evening.
Busy? So what are you trying to do, insult me?
Why, no, not at all. I'm just busy, that's all. You see, we're holding meetings in Jacobson's Hall every evening. Anytime you have a moment to spare, I'll be glad to have you drop in. You're more than welcome.
I heard you. But you ain't kidding me any. You know, I met your kind before. Why don't you come up sometime, huh?
Well, I...
Don't be afraid, I won't tell.
But,
Come up, I'll tell your fortune. Ah, you can be had.
Of course,
you can be had.
The male voice there was...
That was Cary Grant, wasn't it?
Yeah. A young Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Who had at that point not quite become Cary Grant. He was still on his way to finding himself.
And what was his original name? Archie?
Archie Leach.
Archibald Leach. And what happened to Mae West? What did I read about this production code that came into effect?
Oh, well, Mae West, you have to understand with Mae West is that she'd been a sensation, a very bawdy sensation in New York on the stage for, you know, a decade and a half before she came to movies. She really was sort of the Madonna of her day. She even had a play called Sex that ended up getting her arrested and put in jail for a couple of days, which was just sort of like her latest production and made her more famous than ever. And Paramount Pictures, run by Adolph Zukor, they're in the midst of the Depression. They were about to go under. So he signed her up, and she was one of the first talking stars to really have be a huge sensation. And it wasn't, she couldn't have been a silent film star. You needed to hear Mae West to get that whole package, that sort of cynicism, that raciness, that risqueness. And the industry was terrified of putting her on the film, putting her on screen, because they were in the midst of clamping down on on-screen morals. There was a whole battle going on about whether movies are good for the children and good for people, the same argument we're still having.
Right.
And there were lots of state censorship boards busily cutting up films, and so the industry created the producers group, basically the forerunner of the MPAA, and installed a censor. It was called the Hayes Office, but it was really run by a guy named Joseph Breen. And for about 4 or 5 years, they had this code, but they didn't really enforce it. And so for the early sound years, you get some amazingly racy movies, including Mae West's. And then after a while, they started clamping down. And you can really see the difference in, for instance, between the first Tarzan movie, in which Tarzan and Jane barely wear any clothing at all, and in fact, there's like an underwater nude swim, and then the second Tarzan movie, everybody's got loincloths where they should.
I want to get back to the power that the studios had. When did that shift? When did they lose this power over these actors?
Oh, that really, their power lasted through the World War II era, well into the 50s. And you could say that the studios only really lost their power in the late 50s going into the 60s. There was a Supreme Court case in the late 40s that divorced that basically deemed the film industry a vertical monopoly and made them get rid of their theaters. And that was the first blow. But more to the point, audiences started looking at different kinds of stars. And one of the points I make in my book is that every generation basically kills off its parent stars and creates and finds new personalities that reflect the reality of what they're going through. And the first one of that in the post-war era was Marlon Brando. Who was not only a completely new kind of actor, very intuitive, very spontaneous, but a new kind of star, one who thought stardom was ridiculous. You'd never heard that from Clark Gable. He really resisted the whole celebrity machine, which, of course, made him a bigger celebrity, much to his confusion. But he's sort of the first person in this process in the post-war era going into the 60s of audiences looking for more and more realistic, less glamorous types, so that by the time you get into the 60s, you've got somebody like Dustin Hoffman, who is certainly not Louis B. Mayer's idea of a movie star.
Why don't we listen to a little of Marlon Brando and watch his evolution?
Hey, shut up! You put that howling down there and go to bed!
Joyce, I want my clothes out here!
You shut up! You're going to get the law on you.
Stella!
You can't beat on a woman and then call her back because she files on you. I've got a life
down here.
You stink.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
We're going for a price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody. instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
You look terrible. I want you to eat. I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
Too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
Famous last words. So what shifted with Marlon Brando?
Oh, audiences started distrusting, as I mentioned, Hollywood glamour. And, I mean, this is part of coming out of World War II, which made the, you know, everybody went, across the ocean, participated in this hideous, violent conflict that really stripped away any naivete that was remaining in their outlook of the world. And they came back into these Hollywood movies that pretended things were as peachy keen as they had been. And not only did audiences sort of respond to that and say, no, it's not like that anymore, certain stars did. Jimmy Stewart is a really interesting case of somebody who, he went to war, he flew bombing missions, he saw death close hand, and he came back and he told the story of watching his early 30s movies, and he said they made him want to vomit because they just had nothing to do with who he was, and he knew he said, I knew I had to toughen up. And he started actually consciously adjusting his personas. He started making these tough westerns with Anthony Mann. He made the Hitchcock films, Rear Window, Vertigo, which are really dark Jimmy Stewart kinds of movies. He really started playing with its persona in a way that very, very few stars of that generation did. But elsewhere, audiences were looking for stars that reflected a grittier, more cynical reality. So you get people like Kirk Douglas, you get people like Robert Mitchum, you get shady ladies like Veronica Lake and Ava Gardner. And that process keeps going until you get into the counterculture era, where you have a generation that wants to see themselves on the screen, and they look to people like Dustin Hoffman and Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda and so on.
We're speaking with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. We're talking about his book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. If you'd like to join in the conversation with a comment or a question, easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Email is radio@WLRN.org, and you can tweet us, that's @topicalcurrents. Tell me, Ty Burr, what separated, say, a Clark Gable from a Van Johnson?
From a Van Johnson, interesting. Why did you pick him?
Well, because he was very handsome. They were kind of contemporaries.
Yeah, Van Johnson was actually sort of the second generation of the golden era. He was a favorite with the Bobby Soxers. He was young. He was like the new teen idol in a way, before teen idols really became common currency. Gable was really a sensei. He, along with Mae West and Shirley Temple, were like the first sensations of the early 30s talkie revolution. And Gable certainly understood what it was to be molded. MGM used to take him out for photo sessions where he'd be hunting and fishing. They tried to create this persona of a man's man, and he didn't hunt, he didn't fish. But the funny thing is, he started picking those hobbies up because he kind of wanted to turn himself into the person MGM was molding him as. And you get that actually a lot. The stars themselves, so the actors kind of reverse engineered their own personalities from the persona the studio made for them. Van Johnson's a little later. He comes in the early 40s, and again was young, was handsome, was wholesome, and teenage girls flipped for him. He was, if World War II hadn't come around, he would have been like the first in a sort of next generation of wholesome Hollywood stars, but the war kind of changed what people wanted.
What is changed today? I mean, in addition to everything that's changed today, but what is it about actors making a point of not changing their names?
Well, that sort of comes in with Brando and all that followed, a certain insistence on realism and grittiness and earthiness, and a spurning of the Hollywood process of reinventing people. Today you get, somebody like Mia Wasikowska. She would never have that name if she was in 1930s Hollywood. She would be, Jane Powell or something.
Even James Gandolfini. I mean, that's not...
Yeah, absolutely. And there you're getting into, you know, I mean, back in the 30s, he would have been a character actor. He would have been a character heavy. He would never have been perceived as a star. The landscape has changed so much, and we have so many different ways of telling stories on so many different platforms that you can have different kinds of stars in different areas. And TV really helped to change that. In fact, TV, when TV came around in the post-war era, that was another big change because the stars that TV created were different from the stars that people were getting in movies. In the movies, they still wanted larger-than-life glamour figures. On TV, you have Jackie Gleason playing a bus driver. You have Lucille Ball, a former movie star playing a ditzy housewife. They tended to, and it was the characters that were stars almost more than the actors. I mean, we think of Samantha Stevens. We don't think of Elizabeth Montgomery. We think of Archie Bunker. We don't think of Carol O'Connor. The stars, the personas were smaller, more like us, and more life-size.
You said the secret mascot of your book is Mickey Rooney. What did you mean by that, and what was his star appeal?
Mickey Rooney's star appeal is that he's completely unhinged. He has an energy that is unquenchable, unstoppable, and has been bottled successfully and unsuccessfully throughout film history. At this point, he has the longest career of anybody in the movies. I show a clip from a silent film from like 1926 in which he shows up. He's 6 years old. He shows up playing a midget in a cowboy hat.
Hey, gang, let's have a show.
Yeah, and then he goes on to that. And in the late 30s, for about 3 years, he was the most popular box office attraction in the country. He was the number one movie star. And then after World War II, he couldn't get arrested and made a bunch of B-movies. And then he was perceived to be washed up. And then he came back on Broadway and was nominated for a Tony. And then he wins an Emmy. He just, in his ups and downs and his comings in and out of fashion and his sheer longevity, he is really almost the history of American movie stardom. Just, it's ups and downs, everything, it's all there. And he's still with us, and he's still acting. He's just, I don't think he'll ever die.
Well, you may be right, although George Burns did. Although I
eventually,
guess he,
eventually. After playing God.
Right. Which stars caused the biggest disconnect for you? I mean, who do you think has star power that surprises you, and who doesn't that you think would or should?
Today or
yes.
In the classic era?
Anytime.
Oh, boy, that's a very interesting question. It always comes down to personal taste. I am absolutely astounded that Ashton Kutcher is a star. I don't get it. I am curious. I'll go see him play Steve Jobs just because I'm just curious to see he seems to me a trained poodle. And yet he's popular. So I absolutely do not get that. There are stars who, you know, the wonderful thing about breadth of stardom is that everybody has their favorites. Everybody has their, you know, and everybody has their movie crushes, you know, and you may not even, it has nothing to do with whether they're good actors or not. You know, I'll watch anything Ashley Judd is in. I think she's a fine actress, but I just like watching her. My wife, God love her, will watch anything Keanu Reeves is in. And again, it has nothing to do with whether he's a good actor. She just likes to look at him. And that's another through line in the history of stardom is that on a very basic level, we just like to look at pretty people in nice clothes. There's, you know, it's a very fundamental thing. It's a way of, on one level, it's a way of playing with dolls as a grown-up. On another level, it's creating, using them as a mythology in the way that people, you know, 2,000 years ago told stories about Greek and Roman gods to act out these sort of various dramatic dilemmas we go through and sort of see what happens if you do this or you do that. It's a very, very complicated thing. But I do have my favorites, and I do have, you know, there are certain actors right now who I'll watch in anything. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think he's, you know, I don't know if you'd call him an A-list star, but he's creative, he's interesting, he's got a sense of humor. I will watch him do anything. For now, I will go where he goes.
Okay.
Why did it take Humphrey Bogart so long to become such a big star?
Well, as I say in the book, certain stars have to, you know, be left outside to age like firewood or scotch. He was around for about 12 years in Warner Brothers movies mostly, playing gangsters, playing second-rung gangsters who get, killed off in the final reel. He wasn't likable. He kind of played a heavy. There was something shifty about him. you had to age a bit and get some sort of accumulated wisdom, and the movies had to, and the culture, I think, had to age to the, you know, mature to the point where they could look at a character like him and attach some sympathy to him. And so in 1 year, I think it was 41, he's in The Maltese Falcon, and he's in, what's the name of the movie where he plays the gangster who gets out of jail, and it's the gangster, High Sierra, where he's a gangster you feel sorry for, and you feel like the world is against him, and all of a sudden, people's idea of who Bogart was changed, and he became this tough, you know, rumpled hero who, one of the reasons that he's a hero is for the distance he's already traveled, you know, the things he's seen and the things he's mastered. He had to grow up a little bit and grow old a little bit before he would become this major star.
We're speaking with Ty Burr. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe, and formerly he wrote for Entertainment Weekly, and 30 years as a serious movie watcher. He's the author of several books. His latest is Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll come back and we'll take some calls. Stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by All Air of South Dade, offering air conditioning solutions and service in Miami-Dade County. For more information or to schedule an appointment, you can simply dial **COOL from your cell phone. That's **2665 and send.
For many, a charitable bequest is a unique expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977. You've reached a certain age. You're viewed as a success. Still, you are not immune. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. West Palm Beach's Hanley Center is considered a center of excellence for comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery for older adults and baby boomers. Hanley Center for Older Adult and Boomer Recovery. Details at 855-718-2233. Hanley Center, Recovery for Life. 855-718-2233.
And we return 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman and Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-WLRN or email, that's radio@WLRN.org or Twitter at Topical Currents. First caller, this is Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? Great show today, guys. I just want to make a comment to your speaker. Back in 67, when Dennis Hopper and Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda were really at the almost the pinnacle of their careers as far as being relevant to the teens and you know, young 20-somethings back in that era, they actually got together and made a movie called The Trip. And and I encourage anyone and everyone who's ever been interested in true counterculture movies to really check that out. Unfortunately, I wasn't around in that era, but, you know, my
Was that the one that was shot in the Florida Keys?
I don't know. Maybe.
I saw that movie and it was pretty bad.
Well, it was bad, but if you really wanted to see the true, like, Haight Ashbury, you know, zebra-painted walls and those types of things, it was actually directed by Dennis Hopper, and Jack Nicholas wrote it, and Peter Fonda starred in it.
Hmm.
But, you know, as far as period movies go, you know, it's hit or miss, but that is an all-star cast. That would be something equivalent to Brad Pitt and, you know, you name just about any other heavy hitters getting together to make, you know, arguably a low-budget movie, but as far as counterculture movies go, it's very obscure, but very accurate. I'd just like to hear a comment about it, if he's seen it.
That was when they were working, when Hopper and Nicholson, they were all working for Roger Corman and making these little B-movies that nobody in the culture, you know, in the high culture took seriously until the next year when they made Easy Rider, and everything changed with that, and that made so much money that the industry suddenly realized there was a youth audience there. The Trip is, I mean, it's not a great movie, but as you say, it's a total time capsule, as is the one they made the following year, called, which is I like even more just as a time capsule movie. It's called Psych Out. And it's got Jack Nicholson with a ponytail. It's got Bruce Dern as like an acid casualty who thinks he's Jesus. It's got Dean Stockwell. It's got Susan Strasberg as the deaf mute runaway. I mean, everybody's in this thing. And it, again, it ain't great art, but if you really do want to get, as with The Trip, you want to get a sense of what it was really like then, that's the movie to look at.
Wow, that's great. The Psych Out. I'm definitely going to check it out.
Oh, yeah, no, you should see that one. That's a double bill. Wow, that's a double bill, The Trip and Psych Out.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thanks. So I wanted to ask you, where were the greatest incongruities between the persona and the person that you encountered either in your life or in your research? Like, I know you mentioned Jimmy Cagney being a really nice guy and his mm-hmm. persona was a, you know, gangster. And what were some others?
Well, you know, a lot of these personas were fairly simple, and they mask a fairly complicated person behind them. Cary Grant is a perfect example of, you know, we think we know who Cary Grant is. And even Cary Grant was unsure of who Cary Grant was and had a number of quotes where he said, you know, I've sort of gone back and forth between Archie Leach and Cary Grant, unsure of who's who and which one I am. And when you think that he actually, in the late 50s, experimented extensively with LSD under the care of a psychiatrist, which just boggles my mind, the idea of Cary Grant saying, you know, oh, wow, look at my hand, you know, and was quite bitter about the fact that he never got an Oscar. He was a very complicated person, and yet you have this persona of absolute ease and balance. You know, you look at the Tracy and Hepburn is this great Hollywood love story. The more you read about it, the more it looks like a very problematic relationship involving alcoholism and enablement. And, you know, the stories we tell ourselves about the stars off screen as well as on do not necessarily match the reality of their lives. I think it's more difficult to do that today. Mm-hmm. And in my own, you know, my own dealings with actors and celebrities when I interview them, well, first of all, in that setting, they tend to play nice, especially when they're promoting a movie. Only once with a particular legendary golden age actress was I treated very nastily, and I won't mention names.
It's in the book, isn't it?
No, it's not in the... yes, it is in the book.
Yes, it's in the book.
So who is it?
Should I tell?
Lauren Bacall. This is nothing new there. She's known for...
Actually, I interviewed her in the 70s when she was working Miami Beach, and she was very kind.
Was she?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had a good experience. I did not. But by and large, and most, you know, some people are who they seem to be on screen. Jodie Foster is exactly who you would think she is, which is interesting because she's somebody who obviously puts a strong premium on privacy and has spoken about that. But when you meet her in person, she's exactly as articulate and intelligent and thoughtful and funny as you would think she would be. And she actually, she's a great interview because she never stops talking and her mind's always kind of... yeah.
Let's continue on in the 60s, Ty, and the phenomenon of Dustin Hoffman, who could have been somebody like your math teacher. What made him so special?
Well, the stories about his being cast in The Graduate are well known, but they're so telling that they're worth telling again. There's Mike Nichols, the director. He actually originally auditioned Robert Redford, and in fact, if you've read the book The Graduate, the character of Benjamin Braddock is this sort of blonde WASP god, and so he auditions Redford, and he's not getting quite the insecurity he kind of wants in the character, and he says to Redford, "Hey Bob, have you ever struck out with a girl?" And Redford says, "What do you mean?" And
what does that mean?
What does it mean to not be successful, you know, with a girl? And Nichols kind of thought, no, this is not what I want. And Hoffman shows up, and he completely blows his audition. He's nervous. He's fubsy. He pinches Catherine Ross on the butt, and she slaps him. And it just looks like a total fiasco. And then Nichols looks at the rushes, and it turns out that Hoffman is one of those guys that does tiny little things that magnify on the screen to perfect size. And he had the insecurity and he had the uncertainty. So they make the movie, and Nichols is showing it to industry executives, and they all come up to him afterwards and say, "Mike, it's a wonderful movie. It's just a shame about the boy. It's just too bad." Because it was a new paradigm. They couldn't get their minds around the fact that this schlumpy, short, dark-haired, beak-nosed guy would be a movie star.
Let's listen for a second, and then we'll go back.
Sure.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mr. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
And you know what? It's that "aren't you" that makes the difference.
Yes, it does. Was it his understatedness too, and he was such a sensitive, and still is. He comes off as such a sensitive man, you know?
Well, sensitive and confused. I think it was his confusion and an uncertainty of how to behave in this very confusing grown-up world that he's thrust into that made audiences, younger audiences, and this is what was different. Nobody in the industry thought he was a star. Everybody under 30 who saw that movie said, "Oh my God, that's me. That's exactly what I feel like I'm going through." He is mirroring the uncertainties that I feel like I have, and the feeling about the parents and the parental culture. Of course he's a star. And it was, meanwhile, the reigning culture, somebody said that Hoffman looked like both Sonny and Cher. And another writer said that he will not spell any danger to Rock Hudson in the, sort of sexual magnetism front, which is, of course, insanely ironic now that you think about it.
Yes.
And it took a while for the industry to catch up, and this is true throughout, the history of movies, for the industry to catch up what the audiences had already discovered.
Now, was his first film, wasn't it? The Graduate,
he'd been in, I think, one or two other ones before, but certainly his first starring role, and he was, he thought of himself as a New York actor. Ironically, he was all set to play in The Producers, Mel Brooks' The Producers. He was going to play the Nazi playwright. And then he had to go back to Mel Brooks and say, "Sorry, I'm going to be in this other movie where I'm going to be having sex with your wife."
We're speaking with Ty Burry. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe, and his book is Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. It's currently 87 degrees in Miami. Tune into WLRN TV 17 for Carole King, the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize in Performance at the White House, a star-studded musical tribute to Carole King. That's Saturday, July 27th at 8 p.m. on WLRN TV 17.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Tuesday's Topical Currents when we discuss the book Deep State, Inside the Government Security Industry, with the Atlantic editor D.B. Grady. He's written about the astonishing number of secrets held by the government and the industry which has arisen to perpetuate them. He says necessary secrets are seldom kept, while trivial ones are kept forever. Learn more on Topical Currents Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. His book is Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. And for those of you who are interested in getting the book, we will have that link on the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as our website, WLRN.org. Ty Burr, let's turn to Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. I remember seeing Cleopatra when I was a kid on the big screen. And then all of the scandal that went on.
Right. I mean, you went to see Cleopatra. I mean, it's not a great movie, but it is a great star vehicle. And that was the moment where Liz Taylor became bigger than her stardom, bigger than anything, you know, around it. And I would argue that at that point, she was bigger than the movies she was in. And she's an interesting case in that she is somebody who had come out of the Star Factory, had been a child actress. She's sort of the anti-Judy Garland, where Judy Garland kind of got ground down by the factory system. Elizabeth Taylor gained control over her persona and herself, and, you know, she's in National Velvet as a kid, but then you see her in Father of the Bride, and she's this lovely ingenue. And then starting with A Place in the Sun, where she plays this debutante who whispers into Montgomery Clift's ear, tell mama all, you realize that, oh my goodness, this is somebody who's a little more complex, a little deeper, and a little more sexual in ways that the movies have not figured out how to countenance. And then, you know, eventually she's in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and Butterfield 8, and she starts having this persona outside the movies as, I mean, she sort of was, you know, a proto-Angelina Jolie, or Angelina Jolie is, you know, what's Elizabeth Taylor, a pale later version, in that she's stealing people's husbands, she's having, you know, she almost dies at one point and then wins an Oscar. Her real-life drama, a real-life narrative, becomes more compelling than any of the movies she's actually in.
I'd like to move to the present when all we need is a camera and internet access to become a star. Let's talk about that and how it's changed the landscape of what a star is.
Well, it's a very, very interesting point, and it's one that I make throughout the book, is that technology over the course of this media century has slowly brought the tools of celebrating ourselves, of making stars of ourselves, closer and closer to us, to the point where now, you know, and this is the example I always use, I got a 16-year-old daughter who can, in theory, come home from school, shoot a movie with her cell phone, edit it on her computer, put it on YouTube, and in theory be seen by everybody around the planet. 30 years ago, only a movie studio and their stable of stars could do that. So it is a profound empowerment of the audience, and it allows us to try on masks and try on personas. And it's new to people of our generation, and it's second nature to people of our children's generation. And where it's going, I'm not sure. I think there's, in certain ways, it's quite freeing. In certain ways, it's ridiculously narcissistic. But that may just be adolescents in general. I do know
that... It's not just adolescents who do it, though.
That's true. That's true. Well, it's becoming a way of life, a hall of mirrors. But I also know that it puts the traditional movie star in a very curious bind. Do we need them? Do we need them for the same reasons that we needed them before, to act out? You know, back in the 30s, women would go to Betty Davis movies basically to see what Betty Davis would get away with this time. You know, in The Letter, she opens the movie, literally the first shot of the movie is her shooting her lover down in cold blood. Oh, my God, what's going to happen next? Yeah, and for, you know, and trust me, half the women in the audience saw that opening scene and thought, no, that's a nice little fantasy. And we don't need a Betty Davis to do that for us now, because we can play out those fantasies and possibilities ourselves and in ways we're not even fully conscious of. So where does that leave like a George Clooney? Where does that leave, you know, an Anne Hathaway? Do we need them in the same way? And I think one of the instances I look toward is somebody like Tom Cruise, who all of a sudden starts behaving not like Tom Cruise. He's not sure of what to do, and he starts jumping up and down on Oprah's couch and being more vocal about his personal beliefs. And the culture kind of turns on him. And you also have this, because of the nature of the internet, any misstep a celebrity makes is immediately put up there for the world to see. You know, think about Alec Baldwin's cell call to his daughter, Mel Gibson's various missteps, Lindsay Lohan's, you know, it's all there.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, and we can not only access their secrets in a way that the old studio heads, you know, used to bury, but we can play with them and repurpose them. And there's this whole cargo cult of messing around with celebrity image on the internet.
Do you think there's an element of revenge there?
Yes. Not long-term revenge, but, you know, we need the stars, we're envious of them, we kind of want what they have, and we also resent them for being... We resent them for our giving them our love. What makes them so special that we should, you know, they should be so big? So there is an element of revenge, I think, and an element of mob glee going on. And when a movie star is sort of pulled down in the public square.
Who's today's biggest stars, male and female, in your opinion?
You know, it's always changing, and it's a very different landscape because there are so many different niches for stars. You know, there's reality stars, there's tween stars, there's hip hop stars, there's soap opera stars, there's, you know, and each one has its own little hierarchy of fame. Who are the ones who are the most powerful? In the old sense, you know, Meryl Streep, Leonardo DiCaprio. Ryan Gosling, to an extent, Clooney. I mean, these are people who first of all, movie stars do not run the economy of selling movies the way they used to. It used to be, you know, Will Smith would be in a movie and it was guaranteed a $100 million opening. That's not true. What sells movies these days, for better and, in my opinion, largely worse, is franchises, comic book heroes, special effects, sensation.
Series.
Series, exactly, remakes. And I'm talking about mainstream commercial, not, you know, independent art house stuff. And it's hard for a star to get a toehold. There are people that people like. Mila Kunis, for example, who, you know, shows up in one movie and people really like her and they remember her from a TV show. And so, you know, I know, you know, my daughters and their friends know who she is. And so if she's in a movie, that compels attention. But very, very few have the power that they used to, that sort of godlike power. Clooney is an exception in that he's established himself over the course of his movie career especially, as not only being a handsome box office draw, but being intelligent about the movies he makes, produces, occasionally writes, stars in, so people know he's a class act in a way that they used to look toward people like Cary Grant, but that he also functions as a modern star who's in control of his career and persona. Meryl Streep is a very unique figure. She has the career that even Katharine Hepburn didn't have at the same age, in that she is popular across all sections of the population, which certainly wasn't true in the 80s. In the 80s, you would go see her movies and get these grueling dramas of the human spirit that would just make you need a stiff drink. and after a while, Meryl Streep started tasting like medicine, if you will. But then I think she went back to the well and started having fun and started doing different kinds of movies. And I still remember, I talk about in the book, when I went to see Devil Wears Prada with my older daughter, who was then about 10 or 11, and she turns to me in the dark and she says, "That's Meryl Streep? She's amazing." And following that with Mamma Mia and some of the other films, she is a star to that generation in a way that nobody else has ever really quite been.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we go, any film recommendations?
It's actually an interesting summer at the movies. Probably my favorite movie of the summer is a documentary about music. It's called 20 Feet from Stardom, and it is about the great backup singers of the 60s and 70s.
Oh.
All those voices, like Darlene Love and Mary Clayton, that were on, you know their voices, you know, you've been hearing them all your life, but you don't know who they are. And this is this joyous movie about the human voice that just, it made me happier than any movie I've seen all summer. I really recommend that one.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Ty Burr. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe, and he's written a history, really, of stardom. It's Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Joseph, Bonnie, thank you so much for letting me be on.
A pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. If you'd like to listen again or link a friend, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well, including author and book links, including today's, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with The Nation editor D.B. Grady and the book Deep State, Inside the Government's Secrecy Industry. Now the calendar. On this day in 1844, 169 years ago, the birth of the Reverend William Archibald Spooner, and hence Spoonerisms, when one gets boards whackwards. He was an albino who once asked if the bean was dizzy. Is it kiss to marry to cuss the bride? And on this day in 1972, 41 years ago, comedian George Carlin is arrested for saying the 7 banned broadcast words on stage in Milwaukee. Bonnie, the words are? Well, we still have an FCC. Carlin won 4 Grammys. He died in 28. What was the best thing before sliced bread? One more while we head for Hyannisport. On this day in 1890, 123 years ago, the birth of Kennedy matriarch Rose Fitzgerald in Boston. She lived till age 104. We leave with a brief weather report a la Spooner. It will either drain or drizzle with possible shattered showers. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, stay tuned. Near and How from NPR News is next.
This is 91.